Star Tide Rising, Cassette 5.
Chapter 26. Crydike. The most formal Anglic, spoken carefully by a Neo-Dolphin, would be difficult for a human raised only in man English to understand. The syntax and many root words were the same, but a pre-spaceflight Londoner would have found the sounds as strange as the voices that spoke them. The Dolphin's modified blowhole provided whistles, squawks, vowels, and a few consonants. Sonar clicks and many other sounds came from complex resonant cavities inside the skull. In speech, these separate contributions were sometimes in phase and sometimes not. Even at the best of times, there were stretched sibilants, stuttered T's, and groaned vowels. Speech was an art. Trinary was for relaxation, for imagery and personal matters. It replaced and greatly expanded on primal Delphin. But Anglic linked the Neo-Dolphin to the world of cause and effect. Anglic was a language of compromise between the vocal abilities of the two races, between the hands and fire world of men and the drifting legends of the whale dream. Speaking it, a Neo-Dolphin could equal most humans in analytic thought, consider past and future, make schemes, use tools, and fight wars. Some thoughtful humans wondered if giving the cetacean Anglic had really been much of a favor after all. Two Neo-Dolphins alone together might speak Anglic for concentration, but not care if the sounds resembled English words. They would drift into frequencies beyond human hearing, and consonants would virtually disappear. Kanik allowed this. It was the semantics that counted. If the grammar, the two-level logic, the time orientation were Anglic, pragmatic results were all that mattered. When Crydike took Hikahi's report, he purposely spoke a very relaxed form of Finn Anglic. By example, he wanted to say that what went on here was private. He listened to her while he took the kinks out of his body, diving and racing back and forth across the exercise pool. Hikahi recited her report on the planetology meeting, enjoying the sweet smell of real air in her main lungs. Occasionally she paused and sped alongside him for a stretch before continuing. Right now her words sounded nothing like human speech, but a very good voice writer could have transcribed them.
"He feels very strongly about it, Captain. In fact, Charlie suggests that we should leave a small study team here with the longboat if Streaker tries to escape. Even Brukita is tempted by the idea. I was a bit stunned."
Crydike passed in front of her. He burst out a quick question. "What would they do if we left them behind and we were then captured?" He dove back underwater and sped toward the far wall.
"Charlie thinks he and a detached team could be declared non-combatants, and the Studman Sawat group out on the island as well. He says there are precedents. That way, whether we get away or not, part of the mission is preserved."
The exercise room was in Streaker's centrifugal ring, 10 degrees up the side of the wheel. The walls were canted, and Crydike had to watch out for shallows in the pool's port side. A cluster of balls, rings, and complex toys floated to starboard. Crydike felt much better. The frustration which had built when he listened to Tom Orley's message had abated. He could put aside for a while the depression he felt when he agreed to the man's plan. All that remained was to get the formal advice of the ship's council. He prayed they'd come up with a better idea, though he doubted they would. Crydike swam quickly under a cluster of balls and shot out of the water. He spun as he sailed through the air and landed on his back with a splash. He did a flip underwater, then rose above the surface on his churning tail. Breathing heavily, he regarded Hikahi with one eye.
"I've considered the idea already," he said. "We could leave Metz and his records, too.
Getting him off our tails would be worth 30 herring and an anchovy dessert. He settled back down into the water. Too bad the solution is immoral and impractical. Hikahi looked puzzled, trying to figure his meaning. Think, he asked his lieutenant. Declaring non-combatants might work if we are killed or captured, but what if we escape and draw our E.T. friends chasing after us? Ikahi's jaw dropped open slightly, a borrowed human mannerism.
Of course, I hear it. Kastemene is so very isolated, there are only a few routes in and out. The longboat probably wouldn't make it back to civilization all alone.
Which would mean...
They would become castaways on a deadly planet, with minimal medical facilities. Forgive my lack of foresight.
She turned slightly, presenting her left ventral fin. It was a civilized version of an ancient gesture of submission, such as a human student's sheepish bowed head to his teacher. With luck, Hikahi would someday command ships far greater than Streaker. The captain and teacher within him was pleased with her combination of modesty and cleverness. Well, we'll take their idea under advisement. In case we have to adopt the plan quickly, see to stocking the longboat. Put a guard on it, too. They both knew that it was a bad sign when security precautions had to be taken within as well as without. A brightly striped rubber ring floated past them. Kraidaiki felt an urge to chase it, as he wanted to push Hikahi into a corner and nuzzle her until... He shook himself. As for further tectonic research, he said, that's out of the question. Gillian Baskin has left for your island to take supplies to Orly and to help Sudman study the aboriginals. She can bring back rock samples for Charlie. That'll have to satisfy him. The rest of us will be busy as soon as Suessi gets back here with those spare parts.
Suessi's sure he found what we need at the wreck?
Fairly certain.
This new plan means we'll have to move Streaker. Turning on our engines may give us away, but I guess there's no choice. I'll get started on a plan to move the ship.
Kraidaiki realized this was getting him nowhere. A few hours remained, at most, until Suessi arrived, and here he was talking to Hikahi in Anglic, forcing her to think rigidly and carefully. No wonder he was getting no hint, no body language, no suggestion that an advance might be welcomed or rejected. He answered in trinary. We'll only move her below water, to the crashed ship, empty, waiting. Soon, while battles rack the blackness, filling space with squid-like racket, at a time when Orly, Netbane far away, does make distraction, far away, does truth decipher, drawing sharks to make us safer. Hikahi stared. This was the first time she had heard about that part of the plan. Like many females aboard, Hikahi had a platonic passion for Thomas Orly. I should have broken the news more gently, or better yet, waited. Her eyes blinked once, twice, then closed. She sank slowly, and from her forehead came a faint keening. Kraidaiki envied humans their enfolding arms. He dropped alongside to touch her with his bottle-shaped rostrum. Do not grieve for strong-eyed flyer. Orly's song shall by whales be sung. Hikahi replied sadly.
I, Hikahi, honor Orly, honor captain, honor crewmates. Deeds are done still for one I suffer, for Jill Baskin, dear life cleaner, for her loss and body sorrow.
Shamed, Kraidaiki felt an enclosing shroud of melancholy fall around him. He shut his own eyes, and the waters echoed back to him a shared sadness. For a long time they lay side by side, rising to breathe, then settling once more below. Crydike's thoughts were far away when he finally felt Hikahi drift away. But then she was back, rubbing gently against his side, and then nibbling tenderly with sharp, small teeth. Almost against his will, at first, Crydike felt his enthusiasm begin to return. He rolled over to his side and let out a long sigh of bubbles as her nuzzling became more provocative. The water began to taste happier then, as Hikahi crooned a familiar song taken from one of the oldest of primal signals. It seemed to say, among other things, "Life goes on." Chapter 27 The Island. The night was quiet. Kithrop's many small moons stirred low tides against metal cliffs 100 meters away. Ever-present winds driven without break across the planet ocean tugged at trees and ruffled the foliage. Still, compared to what they had known for months, the silence was heavy. There were none of the ubiquitous machine sounds which had followed them everywhere from Earth, the unceasing whirs and clicks of mechanical function, or the occasional smoking crackle of failure. The squeaking, groaning drone of dolphin conversation was gone, too. Even Kipiru and Saut were absent. At night, the two dolphins accompanied the Kithrop aboriginals in their nocturnal sea hunt. The surface of the metal mound was almost too quiet. The few sounds seemed to carry forever. The sea, a distant rumble of some faraway volcano. There was a gentle moan in the night, followed by a very quiet, gasping cry. "They're at it again," Denny sighed, not particularly caring if Toshio heard her. The sounds came from the clearing at the southern point of the island. The third and fourth humans on the metal mound had tried to find privacy as far from the Abo village and the tunnel pool as possible. Denny wished they could have gone even farther. There was laughter, faint but clear.
"I've never heard anything like it," she sighed.
Toshio blushed and fed another stick to the fire. The couple in the next clearing deserved their privacy. He considered pointing this out to Denny.
"I swear, they're like minks," Denny said, intending to sound sardonic and mock envious, but it came out just a little bitter.
Against his better judgment, Toshio said,
"Denny, we all know humans are among the sexual athletes of the galaxy, though some of our clients give us a run for it."
"What do you mean by that?"
Denny looked at him sharply. Toshio poked a stick into the fire. That had been a pretty brash thing to say. He felt a trifle emboldened by the night and the desire to break the tension by the fire.
"Well, there's a line in an old play, 'Why, your dolphin was not lustier.' Shakespeare wasn't the first to compare the two horniest of the brainy mammals, you know. I don't suppose anyone's come up with a scale to measure it, but I'd have to wonder if it weren't a prerequisite for intelligence. Of course, that's only one of the possibilities if you take what the Galactics say about uplift into account."
He rambled on, slowly drawing away from incitement, noticing how Denny came this close to blowing her cool before she turned and looked away. He'd done it. He had played a round and won it. It was a minor victory in a game he had wondered if he would ever get to play. The art of teasing had always been a one-sided affair to Toshio, and he'd always had the short end. To get the best of an attractive older woman by dint of clever conversation and character insight was a coup. He didn't think he was being cruel, though a genteel cruelty did seem to be part of the game. All he knew for certain was that this was one way to get Denny Sudman to treat him less like a child. If some of the easy mutual liking they'd had before had to suffer for it, that was too bad. Much as he didn't care for Saut, Toshio was glad the Finn had provided the lever he needed to pry a chink in Denny's armor. He was about to try out another bon mot when Denny cut in.
"I'm sorry, Tosh. I'd love to hear the rest, but I'm going to bed. We have a busy day tomorrow, launching Tom's glider, showing Jillian the Kikui, and experimenting with that damned robot for Charlie. I suggest you get some sleep, too."
She turned to wrap herself in her sleeping bag at the far end of the camp near the watchwards.
"Yeah,"
Toshio said, perhaps a bit too heartily.
"I'll do that in a bit, Denny. Good night, pleasant dreams."
She was silent with her back to the tiny glow from the fire. Toshio couldn't tell if she was asleep or awake.
"I wish we humans were better at psi," he thought. "They say telepathy has its drawbacks, but it would sure be nice to know what's going on in another person's head sometimes. It'd take away a lot of the anxiety if I knew what she was thinking, even if I found out she just thought I was a nervy kid."
He looked up at the patchy sky overhead. Through long, ragged openings in the clouds, he could see stars. In two places, there were nubiculi in the sky that hadn't been there the night before, signs of a battle still raging. The tiny false nebulae glowed in every visible color, and probably in other bands than light. Toshio let a fistful of metallosilicate dirt sift through his fingers onto the coals. Falling sparkles of metal winked at him like incandescent confetti, like winking stars. He dusted off his hands and turned to crawl into his own sleeping roll. He lay there, eyes closed, reluctant to watch the stars or to dissect the pros and cons of his behavior. Instead, he listened to the wind and surf sounds of the night. They were rhythmic and calming, like a lullaby, like the seas of home. Except once in a while, he thought he could pick up, on the edge of hearing, sighs and soft laughter coming from the south. They were sounds of complex happiness that filled him with a sad longing.
"They're at it again," he sighed to himself. "I swear, I've never heard anything like it."
The humid air kept their perspiration slick upon them. Jillian licked a mustache of tear-like salt off her upper lip, the same way Tom cleaned some of the sheen off her breasts. The wetness of his mouth cooled on her aureoles and nipples when he took his mouth away. She gasped and grabbed the wavy hair at the back of his head, where his slightly balding vanity feared no tugging. He responded with mock biting that sent shivers to her calves, thighs, and lower back. Jillian locked her heel behind his knee and levered her pelvis up against his. Her breath whistled softly as he lifted his head and met her eyes.
"I thought what I was doing was after play," he whispered a little hoarsely. He made a show of wiping his forehead. "You should warn me when I cross over the line and start promising what I can't deliver."
He took her hand and kissed its palm and the inside of her wrist. Jillian ran her fingers along his cheek to touch, feather light, his jaw, throat, and shoulder. She took sparse clumps of chest hair and pulled playfully. She purred, not like a house cat, but with the feral rumble of a leopardess.
"Whenever you're ready, love. I can wait. You may be the illegitimate son of a fecund test tube, but I know you better than your planners ever did. You have resources they never imagined."
Tom was about to say that, planners or no planners, he was the quite legitimate son of May and Bruce Orley of Minnesota State, Confederacy of Earth. But then he noticed the liquid welling in her eyes. Her words were rough, light, and teasing, but her grip on his chest hair only tightened as she looked up at his face, eyes roaming, as if memorizing every feature. Tom felt suddenly confused. He wanted to be close to Jillian on their last night together. How could they be any closer than they were right now?
His body pressed against hers, and her warm breath filled his nostrils. He looked away, feeling somehow he was letting her down. Then he felt it, a tender stroking that seemed to strive against a locked and heavy feeling inside his own head. It was a soft pressure that would not go away. He realized that the thing fighting it was himself. "I'm leaving tomorrow," he thought. They had argued over who would be the one to go, and he had won. But it was bitter. He closed his eyes. "I've cut her off from me. I may never come back, and I've cut off the deepest part of me." Suddenly, Tom felt very strange and small, as if he were stranded in a dangerous place, the sole barrier between his loved ones and terrible foes. Not a superhero, but only a man, outnumbered and about to gamble all he had. As if he were himself. He opened his eyes as he felt a touch on his face. He pressed his cheek against her hand. There were still tears in her eyes, but also the beginnings of a smile. "Silly boy," she said. "You can never leave me. Haven't you realized that by now? I'll be with you and you'll come back to me." He shook his head in wonder. "Jill, I..." He started to speak, but his mouth was stopped as she pulled him down to kiss him hungrily. Her lips were hot and tender upon his, crosswise. The fingers of her right hand did insightful things. Still and all, it was the heady, sweet smell of her that made him realize that she had been right about him once again. Part 3. Dissonance. Animals are molded by natural forces they do not comprehend. To their minds, there is no past and no future. There is only the everlasting present of a single generation, its trails in the forest, its hidden pathways in the air and in the sea. There is nothing in the universe more alone than man. He has entered into the strange world of history. Lauren Isley. Chapter 28. Sout. All night he had followed them. Toward morning, Sout felt he was beginning to understand. With the dawn, the Kiqui left their nocturnal hunting grounds and swam toward the safety of their island. They stowed their woven nets and traps in hidden coral clefts, took their crude spears, and hurried from the growing light. With daytime, the killer vines would become active, and other dangers as well. By day, the Kiqui could forage the forests atop the Metal Islands, seeking nuts and small animals in the thick foliage. Underwater, the Kiqui looked like green pufferfish, with short, web-handed arms and flippered legs. A pair of almost prehensile ventral fins helped them maneuver. Strong, kicking legs left their hands free to carry burdens. Around each head, a fin-line crest of wafer-thin flagelli waved, collecting dissolved oxygen to supplement each Kiqui's distended air sac. The hunter-gatherers pulled two nets full of bright, crab-like sea creatures, like multicolored metal sculptures in the mesh. The Kiqui sang a song of flutters and squawks and yelps. Sout listened as they squeaked to one another, their tiny vocabulary hardly more than a series of vocalized signals coordinating their movements. Each time a few Kiqui rose to the surface for air, the act was accompanied by a chain of complex twitters. The natives took little notice of the alien creatures that followed them. Sout kept his distance, careful not to interfere. They knew he was here, of course. Now and then the younger Kiqui would cast suspicious sonar squirts his way. Strangely, the older hunters seemed to accept him completely. Sout looked up at the growing light with relief. In spite of the darkness, he had kept his own sonar down to a minimum all night to keep from intimidating the natives. He had felt almost blind and a little panicky when he almost blundered into something, or something almost blundered into him. Still, it had been worthwhile. He felt he had a pretty good grasp of their language now. The signal structure, like primal Delphin, was based on a hierarchical herd and the tempo of the breathing cycle. Its cause-and-effect logic was a bit more complicated than primal, no doubt due to hands and tool use. Look, we well hunt. Hunt, hunted, well. Careful, careful, opportunistic. Eat, eat well, will eat. Not eaten, no. Die above water, not in. Based on semantic ability alone, these creatures seemed less ripe for uplift than fallow earth dolphins had been. Others, biased toward tool-using ability, might disagree. Of course, the fact that they had hands probably meant the Kikwi would never be particularly good poets. Still, some of their braggadocio had a certain charm. The straps of Sout's harness chafed as he rose for breath. In spite of its light weight, streamlined design, he wished he could get rid of the damn thing. Of course, these waters were dangerous, and he might need its protection. Also, Kipiru was out there somewhere, staying out of the way as requested, but listening nonetheless. Kipiru would chew Sout's dorsal fin down to the backbone if he caught him without his harness. Unlike the ultra-technical Fen of Streaker's crew, Sout was uncomfortable with devices. He didn't mind computers, some of which could talk and which helped him speak to other races, but implements for the moving, shaping, or killing of objects, these were unnatural things which he wished he could do without. He hated the two nubby little fingers at the tips of each of his pectoral fins, which they said would someday lead to full hands for his species. They were unaesthetic. He also resented the changes made to dolphin lungs, making them more resistant to land-based diseases and adapting parts to breathing oxywater. Natural cetaceans needed no such mutations. Fallow Stenos bridonensis and Tursiops truncatus dolphins, left untouched by the gene crafters, could outswim any of the Amicus breed almost any time. He was ambivalent to the expanded visual sense, bought at the cost of gray matter once dedicated to sound alone. Sout rose again to breathe, then submerged, keeping pace with the aboriginals. His own line represented a drive to emphasize language ability rather than tool use. It seemed to him a more natural extension of dolphin nature than all this crashing about in starships, pretending to be spacemen and engineers. That was one reason he had refused to go along in the spaceboat to help scout the derelict fleet back at the shallow cluster. Even had there been anything or anyone left to talk to, for which there'd been no evidence, he wasn't about to poke around supported only by a gang of inept clients. For Streaker to try to deal alone with the derelict fleet was like a group of children playing with a live bomb. His actions had won contempt from the crew, even though he had been vindicated by the disastrous loss of the captain's gig. Their contempt didn't matter, Sout reminded himself. He was a civilian. As long as he did his job, he didn't have to explain himself. Nor did disapproving clicks over his pursuit of Denny Sudman bother him. Long before uplift, male dolphins had been fresh with women researchers. It's a long-standing tradition, he rationalized. Whatever was good enough for horny old Flipper is good enough for his brainy descendant. One of the things he hated about Anglic patterns of thought was this need to self-justify. Men were always asking, why? What did it matter, why? There were other ways than the human way of looking at things. Any whale would tell you. The Kikwi chittered excitedly as they swam toward the eastern end of their own island, preparing to hoist their catch up a crevice in the leeward seawall. Sout felt a sweep of sonar like a passing searchlight. Kipiru approached from the north to escort him back to the Earthling encampment. Sout flicked up to the surface. He tilted his head to look out on the new day. The sun rose behind a bank of haze in the east, and the wind carried a whisper of rain on the way. A metal taint seemed to stain the air, reminding him of their deadly predicament on Kithrop. No doubt Krydike and his engineers were trying to jury-rig a scheme to get out of this mess. Their plan would no doubt be frightfully bold and clever, and get them all killed. Wasn't it obvious that neophytes at the game of making and conquering couldn't thwart the Galactics, who had been at it for eons? The humans had his loyalty, of course, but he knew them for what they were, clumsy wolflings struggling to survive in a dangerously reactionary galaxy. There was an old dolphin saying, "All humans are engineers, and all engineers are humans." It was cute, but patently a lie. Kipiru broke surface beside him. Sao blew quietly, his breath condensing into spray. He lay watching the sunrise until Kipiru's patience wore thin.
"It's daylight, Sout. We shouldn't be out here. We've got to report, and I want food and rest."
Sout affected the role of an absent-minded scientist, as if pulled from thoughts deeper than Kipiru might ever understand.
"What? Oh, yes, of course, pilot. By all means, I've very interesting data to report. You know, I think I've cracked their language."
"How nice."
Kipiru's reply was semantically Anglic and phonemically a squawk. He dove and headed for the cave entrance. Sout winced at the pilot's sarcasm, but he was unrepentant. "Maybe I've time to finish a few suggestive limericks to intersperse in my report to Denny," he thought. "It's too bad she stays up on the bank of the pool. Maybe today she'll relent." When they got to the bottom of the former drill tree shaft, now lit by a small phosphor bulb, Sout noticed that someone had taken both sleds out of the passage and moored them in the cavern below. But at least one sled was always supposed to be in the pool, in case Denny and Toshio had to escape quickly. He hurried after Kipiru up the narrow vertical tunnel. There were two more sleds in the pool at the top. Someone must have arrived from the ship during the night. Toshio and Denny were already down by the water, talking to Kipiru. Sout eyed Denny speculatively, but decided not to start in. "This evening I'll try to get her to join me in the water. I'll think up a pretext, maybe something to do with the mechanics of the drill tree route. It probably won't work, but the attempt should be fun." Sout spy-hopped, churning his tail to rise up and look about the poolside clearing. The thick brush parted to the south, and two men, one female and one male, approached. Gillian Baskin knelt by the poolside and whistled a trinary welcome. Constant Kipiru, solid as surf rock, orca defier. Chameleon Sout, ever adaptable, ever so manlike. Under dark squalls, I'd recognize you two. Study in opposites. Kipiru answered in Anglic, a pathetically unoriginal,
"Good to see you, Gillian. You too, Tom.
Sout settled down, uncomfortably aware that he had a reputation to live up to. Unlike Kipiru, he would have to come up with a greeting that matched Gillian's. He would rather have gone someplace to think about Gillian's remark, especially that part about being ever so manlike. Was that a compliment? Or was there a touch of pity in Jillian's upper register when she had whistled it? Orley stood quietly next to Jillian. Sout felt as if the man were seeing through him. Sout drew a breath. Look here, a monogamous miracle, a pair of lovers, silhouetted against the wide sky. Jillian clapped her hands and laughed. Orley smiled briefly, but apparently had things on his mind.
I'm glad you two Finns are back, he said. Jillian and I arrived last night, she from Streaker and I from the site where Toshio's tsunami ship crashed. Jill brought you folks a monofilament cable so you can stay in touch with the ship. She'll work with you for a few days on this vital matter of the Kikwi. Also, I understand there are some folks back at the ship who'd like to ask you to collect some data for them. Isn't that right, Jillian? The blonde woman nodded. Word of Charlie Dart's demands had not delighted Toshio and Denny. Orley continued. Jill's other purpose in coming here was to deliver some gear to me. I have to go away this morning. I'll be using a solar glider. Kipiru sucked air. He started to object, but Orley raised a hand. I know, it's risky, but there's an experiment I have to try in order to see if the escape plan we've put together will work. And since you people are the only ones available, I'm going to have to ask for your help. Sout's tail thrashed under the water. He clamped down to hide his feelings, but it was hard. So hard. So they were truly going to try to escape. He had hoped for better from Orley and Baskin. They were intelligent and experienced, almost mythical agents of the Terrigan's Council. Survivors. Now they were talking madness and expected him to help. Didn't they realize what they were up against? He swam up next to Kipiru, wearing the mask of a faithful, attentive client. But inside, he felt turmoil as he listened to the crazy plan that was supposed to save them from the bug-eyed monsters. Chapter 29 Takata Jim. The ship's council meeting was a disaster. It is worse than I thought, the vice-captain sighed. They planned deception to fool deceivers, and veils to cover whales. Cathar John tossed his great blunt head in agreement.
I hear the code word for this project is the Trojan Seahorse. What does that mean?
It's a literary illusion, Takata Jim replied. He wondered where the bosun had gone to school. I'll explain some other time. Right now, I must think. There must be another way than this suicide plan Crydike and Orley have devised.
The captain didn't listen?
Oh, he's very polite. Blowfish Metz swam in my wake, point by point, and Crydike listened so nicely to both of us. The meeting lasted 4 hours, but the captain decided to go with Orley's scheme anyway. The Baskin femme has already left with supplies for him. The two Stenos drifted quietly for a long moment. Cathar John waited for the vice-captain. Takata Jim's tail slashed.
Why won't Crydike even consider broadcasting the location of our find and have done with it? Instead, he and Orley want to try to trick Sophants, who have been trapping each other for millions of years. We'll be fried. Compared with this plan, even your idea of blasting forth with all guns blazing is better. At least we'd be able to maneuver.
I only offer a glorious alternative to his mad venture, Cathar John said. But I would go with your plan. Think, if we were the ones to find a way to save the ship and crew, would not the benefits go beyond simply preserving our lives?
Takata Jim shook his head. If I were in command, perhaps,
but we are led by this mad, honor-bound genius who will only guide us to doom." He turned away, deep in his thoughts, and swam silently down the corridor to his quarters. G'thaw John's eyes narrowed as they followed the vice-captain. Bubbles from his blow-mouth came out in tiny rhythmic pops. Chapter 30 Aki. It wasn't fair. Almost everybody who counted had been allowed to go with Hikahi to go join the crew working on the Thenanin wreck. The repairs to Streaker were nearly completed, and he was still stuck here, where nothing important was happening at all. Aki drifted at his study station under an air dome near the top of the central bay. Bubbles from below passed unhindered through the pages of a holotext displayed in front of him. Of all the dumb ideas, making him study astrogation while the ship was stuck at the bottom of an ocean. He tried to concentrate on the subtleties of wormhole navigation, but his mind wandered. He got to thinking about Toshio. How long ago had it been since the two of them had time to pull off a decent prank? It must have been over a month since they'd stolen Brukita's glasses and replaced them with Fresnel lenses. I sure hope Toshio's okay. But at least he's doing something. Why did Krydike insist I stay here when they need every decent engineer out of the wreck? Aki tried one more time to focus on the text, but was distracted by a sound. He looked down toward a noisy altercation at one of the food stations. Two Fen were taking turns swatting at each other with their flukes, while a circle of others watched. Aki backed out of the air dome and dove toward the disturbance. "Stop this!" he shouted. "Cut it out now!" He struck out with his own flukes to knock Sathatha and Shrika Joe apart. The observers backed away a little, but the combatants ignored him. They bit and flailed at each other. A kicking fluke struck Aki in the chest, sending him spinning. Aki gulped to catch his breath. How did they find the energy to fight in oxy water? He swam up to one of the observers. "Piktau! Piktau!" He bit the fin on his flank and assumed dominant stance as Piktau whirled angrily. It wasn't easy to face him down. Aki felt very young. But Krydike had taught him what to do. When a fin reverts, make him focus. "Piktau! Stop listening to them and use your eyes! Look at me! As a ship's officer, I order you to help me break up this fight." The glazed expression faded from Piktau's face. He nodded. "Aye, sir." Aki was amazed by the fellow's dullness. Drops of blood diffused into a pink stain as the combatants slowed down, trading blows, their gill lungs gasping for breath. Aki collected three more crew fen, swatting and shouting to get them focused. Then he moved in. He got the Stenos and the cook separated at last and led them under guard toward sickbay. Dr. McKinney could keep them isolated until he reported this to the captain. Aki glanced up and noticed the bosun, G'thaw John, pass by. The giant petty officer didn't even offer to help. He probably watched the whole thing, Aki thought bitterly. G'thaw John wouldn't have needed to cajole the onlookers. He could have intimidated the brawlers with a growl. G'thaw John was headed swiftly for the outlock, his expression intent. Aki sighed. Okay, maybe Krydike had his reasons for keeping me around after all. Now that Hikahi has left with the engineers, he needs help taking care of the dregs that are still aboard Streaker. Aki nosed Shrika Joe to keep him moving. The Steno squawked an almost primal curse, but obeyed. At least I've got an excuse not to study astrogation, Aki thought sardonically.
This ends Side 1 of Cassette 5.